Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Getting money from here to the Philippines and fast. And how informal networks spring up after a disaster. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, this is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 11th of November, Veterans Day. I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdahl. It's been 3 days since one of the most powerful storms in history slammed into the Philippines, and the death toll continues to rise. Food and water are scarce, and some of the people who lost their homes are trying desperately to get out. Others have stayed and are beginning the grueling process of cleaning up and rebuilding. The BBC's Alistair Leithhead is in one of the hardest hit areas of the islands near Tacloban. He shared some of what he saw.
Well, I've come as far as it was possible to come in daylight up the island of Cebu. It's a long, narrow island to the west of Tacloban, where, of course, we've seen most of the pictures and heard most of the accounts where they estimate such a huge number of people have died. Those estimates haven't really been made up here as yet. But certainly from the early indications, it looks like this area has been very badly hit. Just after dark, I reached this area, which is just on the edge of where the devastation begins. From here, all the way up many miles more to the north of this island. And looking around me at the moment, I'm using my torch because it's late. There's no light. The moon is behind a cloud. There's the orange glow of a few fires outside homes. A few pieces of blue light that you get from the fluorescent tubes that people are running off generators. It's very eerie. That sort of half moonlight is making silhouettes of the palm trees that look battered and injured, lolloping in the light breeze. Other trees completely stripped of their leaves, one right down in front of me here on the road, and power cables just hanging down. All the power is out from here right up to the north of the island. And what we'll see from here on in, well, we've been told it's terrible, that some areas everything has been completely flattened. There are piles of metal and wood by the sides of the road. People have already started clearing up, those who've stayed behind. It's such a huge task, even with all the aid that's coming in, just coordinating it, finding the people that need it most, getting the help to them. And we still have no idea at this point as to how many people have died, how many people are injured, how many people still desperately need help from the authorities.
That's the BBC's Alistair Leithhead near Tacloban in the Philippines. And all of that devastation brings huge human need. Big traditional relief organizations like the Red Cross are mobilizing, but there are also many smaller efforts. 4 million Filipino-Americans live in the United States, and Los Angeles is home to the largest community of people with Filipino roots. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler took a look at what local relief efforts look like.
The disaster was personal for Alex Montances. His mother's side of the family is from Tacloban, the city decimated by the typhoon.
I have a lot of first cousins back there who we haven't heard from since Friday. It's a pretty scary situation.
Sitting by the phone waiting, you can feel powerless. So the community has empowered itself. Montances, who works with the National Alliance for Filipino Concerns, says Filipino-Americans are raising money for disaster relief at the grassroots level. To raise funds, one group held a 5K run.
There's really a sense of bayanihan spirit. Bayanihan in Filipino really means like the whole community coming together to help each other out.
$7,000 here, a few thousand there. It may not seem like much. But these small ad hoc relief efforts have some advantages over the big international aid groups. Gene Temple is dean of Indiana University's School of Philanthropy. He says local Filipino groups are best at raising money from that community.
The advantage of these diaspora organizations is that they will know how to mobilize some people at the local level, people who may not think of giving to these larger relief organizations.
And Filipino groups here coordinate with counterparts back in the Philippines who know how to navigate the bureaucracy.
They know the local organizations with whom to work, and I think that's a huge advantage for them.
In fact, the big international aid groups will often partner with local nonprofits to distribute relief. So while they might be small, Temple says the contribution of local relief groups is vital. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Today on Wall Street, the Dow closed at another record high. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Many of us harbor a private dream that we could write a novel, and that our novel would, of course, turn out to be magnificent, praiseworthy, and really successful. And this is more or less what's happening for Garth Risk-Hallberg. He's 34, and his debut novel got a $2 million advance. That's an astonishing amount of money under any circumstance, but even more so when you consider that the book business is not exactly booming right now. We called up Peter Hildick-Smith to talk about it. He's the CEO of Codex, a publishing analyst group. Thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure to be here.
$2 million for a debut novel. That is just an astonishing amount of money for a book. How does that happen?
What the trend seems to be in publishing right now is over the last 4 to 5 years has been probably hundreds, if not billions of dollars invested in the digitization of reading. And the market is beginning to reach a point where we're reaching digital saturation. So I think we're seeing a kind of a back to basics maybe going on here where publishers are realizing it's all about the content and they're willing to pay for great content.
Right, because every story I think about the publishing industry recently has been, oh, books are being undercut by e-readers and Kindles and content being available online. You're saying this is now coming back around the other way?
It seems to be, yes. People are kind of reaching a balance point between their digital consumption and their print consumption. It varies by the device that you own and things like that. But it's looking like it's going to be about one-third digital reading and about two-thirds print reading. So it's still print is still the majority of how people like to consume books, particularly books in long form, as this one certainly is. Can't imagine reading a 900-page novel on my smartphone. I think I'd get carpal tunnel syndrome. But that is, I think, what's happening is people are getting back to a certain balance of reading, and they're finding that the print format is great for these kinds of books.
As you said, this is a long book, some 900 pages. Is that unusual? We've seen a number of pretty big books start to do very well. What are you seeing when you look at the market for long fiction?
Well, we did a study back in the summer, in fact, asking people what the right length was for different kinds of books that they like to read most. In more immersive fiction, the longer the better. Once you're into a great story, you don't want it to end. And so I don't think there really is necessarily a length that's going too far. It's really just whether the story lives up to its billing and it's a great read and it engages you through all those many, many pages and chapters.
I'm going to make a really bad pun here. So the author's name is Garth Risk-Hallberg. Is this a risky proposition by the publisher to put so much money in up front, do you think?
Well, I think anytime you're launching a debut author, it's very risky, particularly in literary fiction. The sort of most consistent parts of fiction publishing tend to be in the genres like thriller or mystery, suspense, romance, where you've got a bunch of people who just really like to read in those particular genres. They find authors that they like. They stick with their authors. They're very loyal to those authors. And those are the names you see, you know, week in and week out on the New York Times bestseller list. So it's really going to be down to the reviews, down to the publicity, down to the early reads, advanced reading copies. You know, Random House will do a fantastic job pre-publicizing the book to influential people in the media, and hopefully that will carry the day.
As someone who likes books, does this get you excited?
When that many people are that excited about a book, yes, I think that gets everybody excited. It creates a lot of attention, and certainly having this big advance be as widely publicized gives it a bigger audience. More people know that it's out there.
Peter Hildick-Smith with Codex, thank you so much for talking with me.
Absolutely. Thanks very much.
3 days is just too long for you to wait for a hot pink microwave or bottle of vegan dish soap? Problem solved. Amazon.com is teaming up with the U.S. Postal Service, and customers in Los Angeles and New York will now be able to get their stuff 7 days a week. Yep, Sundays too, which sounds like great news for customers and translates to good news for Amazon too. But what about the post office? From New York, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
When it comes to working on a Sunday, you might think the U.S. Postal Service would have some trouble delivering. But the post office works more hours than you might think.
Here's a dirty secret. The post office has been delivering on Sundays for quite a while for its express mail service.
Carl Howe is an analyst with the Yankee Group.
This is an opportunity to take advantage of infrastructure they already have in place and make some more money.
The post office brings in about the same amount of money as Amazon does every year, $60 billion. The difference is the post office's business has been steadily declining. Postal analyst John Callen says this could help turn things around.
It comes at a very good time because they're starved for cash.
Callen says teaming up with the Progressive Online company shows that the post office is starting to look to the future.
It helps them play into the growing marketplace of e-commerce so that they don't have to worry so much about the dying marketplace of letter mail.
And Amazon?
It's about time that they did something like this for guys like me.
Tech consultant Tim Beharin is a member of Amazon's Prime service, which offers free two-day shipping. He says it's frustrating to order something on Thursday and know it won't arrive until the following week.
If you're eBay, Amazon, or Google, you still have to deal with instant gratification of a person going to a store and buying what he wants now.
This deal means Amazon can get the customer closer to the immediacy of the brick-and-mortar experience without them having to schlep to the store. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Last week, a Tennessee man's car caught fire and was destroyed. Not a national news story, right? After all, there are about 150,000 vehicle fires in the U.S. every year. But this car was a Tesla, the third Tesla to burst into flames. And within 3 days, the company's stock was down 22%. For a company so focused on a single product, even just a few fires can have a huge impact. Marketplace's David Weinberg has the story.
When the New York Times came out with an unfavorable review of the Model S, Tesla's CEO Elon Musk accused the author of ethics violations.
Which is sort of hilarious and also very Nixonian.
Matt Hardegree is the editor-in-chief of Jalopnik.com. He wrote an article that compared Musk to the famously paranoid president.
And the issue is both, you know, Elon Musk and Richard Nixon had, you know, great visions for the future.
And it's that vision of the future that lots of people credit as the reason for Tesla's success, which at the moment is built around a single product, the Model S electric car.
Whether that's Ford and Henry's Model T or Volkswagen and Dr. Porsche's Beetle, all the world's largest car manufacturers started with one.
But, says analyst Eric Noble, with Tesla, it's a little different.
What's different for Tesla is that there's a very strong argument that the cost of producing Model S is well above the transaction price for the vehicle.
In other words, the company loses money on the Model S. As a result, Tesla, more than any other car company, relies on investor goodwill and high share prices to stay afloat. Those are things that can be influenced by a charismatic, visionary leader who's great at generating buzz. But there are limits to that charisma. When the company's defining product burst into flames, not once but three times, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration started considering an investigation. All three incidents were the result of punctured batteries and not product malfunctions. But nonetheless, investors are starting to worry. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Coming up,
they're positioning products to try and make them as appealing as possible, and they use price in clever ways.
We're being manipulated every time we set foot in a mall. But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks held on to last week's highs in a subdued session today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average inched up 21 points, 0.1%, to close at 15,783. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500 traded essentially flat, the NASDAQ ending at 3919, the S&P at 1771. Specialty drug maker Vero Pharma popped up 25% on news that an Irish competitor agreed to pay $4.2 billion for the company. Tesla charged up 4% as concerns over those recent fires involving its cars died down. Transocean gushed 3.75% higher after the offshore rig contractor said it came to an agreement with financier Carl Icahn. In Europe, Germany's DAX and Britain's FTSE both stepped up 0.3%, and France's CAC 40 rose 0.7%. In Asia, Japan's Nikkei rose 1.3%. The bond market was closed today for the Veterans Day holiday. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. Bond markets reopen after the holiday. The Fourth World Conference on Doping in Sport gets underway in Johannesburg. And remember those resolutions you set back in January? You have 50 days to wrap it up. Wow, that's actually a lot of time. You could totally put that off until tomorrow. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Veterans Day today, and we wanted to bring you a story in the spirit of the day. It's not about parades or commemorations, though, but business. A veterans-only business in California, making wine. Arti Shahani pays a visit to a company called, appropriately enough, Valor.
I say Sangiovese wine grapes, and you probably don't think veterans. Joshua Lane is trying to change that.
Welcome to Valor Winery. Would you like to start at the beginning?
Lane is a 28-year-old former Marine who's made a career change. With $5,000 in savings and a bunch of credit cards, he and a few military buddies started this company, Valor Winery.
Right now I'm using very hot water to rinse and sanitize our bottling machine here.
Valor grows grapes on 5 acres in Livermore, California, and also buys from local growers. The vets make and bottle wine in this warehouse at the far corner of an industrial park.
If you wanted to go sit up on a hill and taste wine and look out over the vineyards, no, that's not what we do here.
Lane says annual sales total about $300,000, and the vets are getting ready to expand into beer with a new brewery. But the startup is about more than making money. Co-founder Kevin Franklin, a medic in Iraq, says it's a safe place for many vets who don't trust veteran services.
If I go up to a doc asking, hey, look, I'm freaking out, I'm losing it, you know, I'm looking for help, well, that could be on your permanent record. Have you ever been committed or anything like that? When in reality, all you were looking for is a friend to talk to.
Though the winery does try to connect veterans with formal services. Hiring mainly vets raises management challenges. One man had his lower body blown off in war, so Lane needs to get him a special wheelchair. Many vets struggle with alcohol, so Lane finds himself giving this lecture quite a bit.
You can go out and get hammered, fine, but do not forget the fact that when you're out there, you represent my company.
Valor Winery is named after the cherished military virtue. But veterans making wine? That defies the delicate, cultivated image of California's wine industry. While political parties and police departments are starting to buy the Valor brand for their events, wine is still a tough market to break into. Valor's chief of marketing is Lane's grandfather, Korean War vet George Lane. And when he pitches to restaurants, he gets a lot of...
Oh, we just ordered some from blah blah, and it's been very disappointing, but we keep plugging away, and we're going to do it.
So how are they doing? To find out, I went to an expert.
My name is Blake Gray. I am the world's best online wine writer.
W. Blake Gray is part of the California Wine Establishment, and I asked him to do a blind taste test. He brought a bottle from the vineyards of Italy. I brought Valor's signature Sangiovese. He doesn't know which is which.
I'm not going to say it's exciting. At this point, I would call it competent.
The next wine gets this analogy.
The lead guitarist jumping in to join the band.
The verdict?
I, given the choice, would probably have both of these in front of me for the whole meal and see which I like better at the end, but I'm betting at this point it would be right.
The one on the right is the Valor label. Back at the winery, after a couple of hours of bottling and dropping a few bottles, the younger Lane pours everyone a drink. In Livermore, California, I'm Arthi Shahani for Marketplace.
Check out what the winery looks like and the Valor Wall at our website, marketplace.org. Believe it or not, the start of the holiday shopping season is already upon us. Yes, it's only November 11th. But stores and online retailers are trying to suck you in with emails, discounts, Black Friday promotions, anything to convince you to spend your money with them. But how much of a bargain are you really getting? Mark Elwood is the author of Bargain Fever, How to Shop in a Discounted World, and he joins me now. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
So when I started reading this book, I have to admit that I felt a little bit like a lab rat when I realized all of the things that stores are doing to us when we shop. It's crazy.
We are being manipulated every time we set foot in the mall.
So what are they doing?
What they're doing is they're positioning products to try and make them as appealing as possible, and they use price in clever ways. For example, when you see in a store there are some very, very expensive, implausibly expensive dresses, you're not supposed to buy those dresses. Those dresses are there to make the normal dresses look a bit cheaper. So that's called anchor pricing. So you look at the expensive dress and think, $1,500, then the $300 one looks like a bargain.
You have the number in here that 40 to 45% of the things that are sold in America in the year 2011 were sold at a discount. What happened?
What happened is very simply, think about TV shows like Hoarders and Storage Wars and Extreme Couponing. What they have in common is stuff, and specifically, too much stuff. Since the early 80s in America, retail space, just brick-and-mortar retail space, has expanded about 4% each year. The population has expanded about 1% at the same time over that period. So when there is too much stuff and not enough people to buy it, what happens? The prices get cut.
You also chart in here the growth of businesses like Groupon. Are they making money, and are the customers actually getting something at a cheaper price?
The customer, the regular person, when you buy a Groupon, you're laughing all the way to the bank or the yoga class or the supermarket because it's a great deal for you. But businesses who do deals with them are really setting themselves up to fail. There's a great McKinsey statistic about how much of an uptick in volume you have to have in your business to offset a 5% price cut. 5% off, you need to increase your business 20%. If you're cutting prices in half, which is really what Groupon normally mandates, think about how many people would have to shop to offset it. It would literally have to be the entire city turns up at the supermarket.
I got dressed this morning and I didn't even think about it. And I looked at what I'm wearing in the studio. I am wearing a dress and boots that I bought online at Gilt Group, which is an online retailer you talk about. They discount designer clothes. Those are clothes I probably wouldn't think about buying if they weren't at a sale. Did I actually save any money?
You did save money. Did you get value for money? That's a good question. The issue around places like Gilt Group or outlet malls, which is all Gilt Group is online, is because there is such competition for merchandise, an awful lot of the stuff they sell is specially made for them. So that doesn't mean it's not great stuff, but it was always meant to be cheap, so it's not always a bargain. And what I always say is, take a look at the label inside the nape of the neck. And if it's the same as the label in a department store, you know that it's off-price merchandise. But if that label has any tiny little tweak on it, it means you're getting something that they always planned to sell cheaply. And I think that's a little cheeky.
Was there anything in reporting this book that just really blew your mind?
Coupon fraud is an almost billion-dollar problem every
what?
Year. It's an unquantifiable number because the industry doesn't really want to focus on it. But gang-cutting coupons and then selling them to corner stores to cash in for cash is a huge issue for the industry, and it costs us a lot of money every year, the fraudulent coupon redemption. And there are constant cases of millions and millions of dollars of coupon fraud.
Wow.
That was one of the things that blew my mind.
The subtitle of this book is How to Shop in a Discounted World. How do you?
You never pay full price ever for anything ever. And if you do, you're crazy. You can always get a discount on anything if you do it the right way.
Mark Elwood is the author of Bargain Fever, How to Shop in a Discounted World. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
We're going to end the show today with this final note on supply and demand of knishes, the Jewish doughy snack food generally filled with potatoes and other yummy things. It turns out that a fire at the country's largest knish maker has created a nationwide shortage. Gabila's Knishes in Long Island usually sells about 15 million knishes a year, and the fire has meant that a shortfall of knishes is now taking place at supermarkets and stores and delis. Gabila's promises that they will soon replenish the nationwide knish supply just in time for the start of Hanukkah. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow inched up 21 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ and the S&P traded essentially flat. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres, and Millie Jefferson directs the show. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.